This is DevOps and Docker Talk, and I am your host, Brett Fisher. In this episode, we're diving into Postgres in containers, and generally just Postgres in production, in CI, and what's going on there, because I am not a Postgres expert. So I asked expert and founder of PG Analyze, Lucas Fiddle, to be on the show to explain a lot of this to us and catch us up with what's going on in the Postgres community, particularly when it comes to containers and production. My co-host Nirmal Mehta is with me, and we dive into everything around containers with Postgres, some of the new stuff going on in Postgres land, including tuning and stuff I didn't even know about Postgres, including storing NoSQL data and vector databases for AI and more. This is an edited version of our weekly live show that you can join on Thursdays at 1 p.m. U.S. Eastern at brett.live. So thank you so much to Lucas, and let's get on with the show. Hello.
Hello, hello.
Nirmal's back.
So Brett, when you've got Postgres in containers, who are you going to call?
The Ghostbusters, aka Lucas.
There we go.
The Podbusters.
Welcome, Lucas, to the show. This is Lucas Fiddle, the founder of PG Analyze, which we're going to get into. We're going to talk about containers, a whole lot of things about databases and cloud native. But Lucas, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. And our mutual friend, well, actually, we all know Laura Taco, and she hooked us up with the connection to you so that we could have a show about Postgres. I actually had to go back and look. We've talked about databases a lot on this show, but we've never had one sort of focused on Postgres specifically in a container. So shame on us. We're fixing it today. 5 years in, we're going to do it. I'm glad you're here.
That sounds great.
So why did you decide to pick Postgres as a focus for your career? Take us back a moment. What is it about Postgres?
What happened? Well, back in 2006, I was putting servers in racks. So that was my first job. It's like in a data center, working with physical servers, which, you know, these days people don't do that much anymore. And we kind of used Postgres back then, but I don't think I was involved in it at that point. Like really where it started was we had a startup, which is kind of like Tumblr, like a multimedia blogging network called Soup, you know, like the what you could be cooking. So we, you know, made all fun jokes of the name. And so the core database of that social network was essentially Postgres, right? Like it was one big Postgres server that was storing all these, you know, blogs that people had and like the posts that people made, all the, you know, fun memes that they were posting. And so Postgres was, you know, our dearest center of the universe with all the problems that come of that. And so that's, I think, where it kind of started, you know, like me just as an application engineer back then being like, hey, you know, what is going on? Like, why is it slow? All that fun stuff. And, you know, over the years, Postgres seemed to stick around.
Yeah, it's still here.
Yeah.
It's still
that's
used.
Right. And it has been here since, you know, 27 years. Like it's really old
for databases. I think it seems so underrated right now. Like,
I mean, it's like the top ranked, you know, database engine of the year. So I wouldn't say underrated, but
okay, fair enough. Well, but maybe in terms of the zeitgeist, like in terms of the new hotness, people sleep on Postgres and its abilities and its maturity.
What we're really talking about there, though, is 27 years of open source databases, which I imagine when it was first, like on the first 0.1 release, someone was like, you're never going to get a data. I mean, those were the years of Microsoft SQL, of Oracle, like those early days. I mean, I'm not even sure Microsoft SQL was around. Like it might have been very early days, if not pre-SQL in 27. Anyway, that was a long last time ago. That was very long.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, in the beginning, Postgres didn't even have SQL, right? Like in the beginning, it was just a database that had like this object relational idea, which made it special. But then, you know, SQL kind of was an addition like later into the project. Not that much later, you know, but like essentially it became like a proper database, I would say, slightly later than the 27 years.
Wow, that's some serious lore there I didn't actually know. So we're fast forward because we're not going to recount every touching of Postgres. I don't even remember when the first time I used it. And now you have a company focused on performance. And let's just talk about that real quick.
Yeah, so PG Analyze is essentially a monitoring and tuning tool for Postgres, right? And it's something I use myself when I work with Postgres. So, you know, in the sense I kind of scratched my own itch, I was like, hey, you know, how do I work better with optimizing those queries, with finding those missing indexes? And so PG Analyze initially started as a side project a little bit over 10 years ago, and we've commercialized it more recently, I would say, over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. We're now, you know, have a small team working on this. Are bootstrapped, so no VC money. It's all, you know, freedom from having to IPO at some point. And so we can just build a good product and, you know, build the best tool that you can use for monitoring Postgres and for optimizing Postgres.
Very cool. So for those of out there, if you have those concerns, I can remember mid-2000s, and it didn't really matter which database, but I can remember where I kept having to jump in, back when we were doing real hardware, rack and stack, like Nirmal says, rack and stack, where developers, and I'm guessing this happens still today, but developers were writing queries, not really thinking about indexing or performance. And the old, someone told me many years ago that I love this sort of analogy of, you don't have a performance problem until you have a performance problem. And that, at least that term makes sense. That saying makes sense to me. But people, as they were more successful as a company, writing their websites on databases or whatever, I think this was specifically a company that was managing housing HOAs and stuff like that. So they had to deal with like pool tickets for going for pool lessons. And they had all these things writing on a database. And they kept getting more and more successful, and it kept getting slower. And really, it wasn't even that complicated. It was buy faster disks, make sure you got indexes for all the queries, and watch your query response. Is that, I mean, disks are, I feel like nowadays, of course, the rule is if you're on a spinning disk, you're doing it wrong, I think, right? So is indexing still step one, make sure you have the right indexes?
Kind of. I mean, I would say it depends, right? Like it really depends on who you're talking with. Sometimes, you know, so disks are still a problem, to be clear, right? The problem nowadays is network storage, right? So people use like EBS in the cloud. EBS is pretty good, don't get me wrong, but it still introduces a latency, right? And so, for example, AWS, you know, most recently introduced a new optimized reads feature, which ultimately is just a fancy way of saying they use a local NVMe drive because that's much faster, right? Mm. And so storage, still you have to think about it. It's just not, you know, spinning disks anymore. It's other considerations in the cloud. But from a, you know, end user perspective, I would say, you know, queries are important, indexes are important, query plans are important, right? So understanding, like, the database, you know, makes a decision how to run your query. And so I think where I see the most people, you know, struggling from the application engineering perspective is, you know, a query is slow, and then they start looking at what the database is doing, and then they're like, okay, this hash join, sequential scan, like aggregate node, like they just get confused, right? Like, and I feel like even as somebody who actually creates tools for Postgres, I feel like we're not doing a good enough job yet at making that more approachable.
I was just going to say, with the use case spread, the Postgres's evolution over time has now started to cover so many more use cases and cover so much more ground that it might be hard to keep up with the complexity of what Postgres can support while also understanding how it's making those decisions. So I think you were just about to go into what are some of the pain point areas that you see your customers and people that are adopting Postgres go into?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's good that you mentioned, so these days, right, like last 2 years or so, you know, Gen AI, well, I guess the last year really is when Gen AI has taken off, right? And Postgres, in a sense, I think, has had a really interesting development there with PG Vector, right? So PG Vector is a project by Andrew Kane, which essentially lets you store embeddings inside Postgres and kind of, you know, do stuff like RAGs and whatnot. I'm not an ML expert, not an AI expert, but you can use it essentially to build your AI apps, right? To store some of that data that you would otherwise store in a vector database inside Postgres. And so in a sense, you know, if you have this PG Vector using application, a lot of the things are still the same, right? You still have queries, you still have indexes, like there's special index types that PG Vector has, like IFVF flat and such. And so you have to understand some of the specialities, but then, for example, to debug a slow query, you still use an explain statement, right? You still essentially get a query plan. You still have, for example, a join with, you know, other parts of your data. And so I think if you have that basic skill set, you know, it applies even if you're building a modern application in the AI space.
So what are some of those hot, like the top three areas that people don't look at or should start looking at when they're starting to tune the performance of their Postgres queries?
Yeah, I think, and we should definitely get to containers at some point.
Yes.
But let's talk about tuning a little bit.
Maybe as it relates to running Postgres in a container as well, right?
Sure. Well, the interesting thing is, for the most part, I think it's actually kind of agnostic to where you deploy it, right? So I think if you're thinking from a tuning perspective, the one thing that I think a lot of people obsess over, but I don't think it's actually that important, is parameter tuning. So, you know, in a sense, you know, it's important to set the right config settings so that, you know, the database is like tuned optimally. But, you know, that's kind of a half a day exercise and then you're done, right? So it's not the kind of thing that you keep doing. And so I think in terms of ongoing work, if you think about what are the three most important things to know, right, is like, I think understanding query plans, right? Like understanding how the database makes a decision, ultimately seeing the database as just another piece of software, right? Like it's as if you had a function call in your own software and you just looked at the source code for the function and it just happens to look slightly different because it's a query plan. But really thinking about this as, you know, an extension of your software versus a magic box that just does things, right? So I think there's a lot of upskilling that we should be doing more, I think, to make people comfortable with that. I think indexes, you mentioned, right? So indexes is, I think, something where, for example, PG Analyze, we created a tool called PG Analyze Index Advisor, which is essentially trying to give you automatic recommendations on which indexes you might be missing, right? So imagine you have 100 queries or 1,000 queries in your system. It just becomes so much text, in a sense, to look at, right? You're looking at SQL statements. Maybe you don't even recognize the SQL because you'll usually work in an ORM on your application side. And so what we've created to kind of solve this problem is essentially a way to do indexing better. And I could probably, you know, fill a full hour talking about indexing, but suffice to say, whether you use a tool like ours or you kind of make index choices yourself, I think most important there is looking at the whole workload, right? So not just looking at an individual query, but really saying, what are the different patterns, how we're querying, which columns are we using, which operators, right? So Postgres has these equality operators and like containment operators, and then PG Vector has all its own set of operators. And so you got to understand kind of how your queries look at your data to then make the right index choices. And you asked for the third thing, and I'm sure I could come up with one, but you know, we could also...
Well, we'll probably come up with it. There's some good questions already, and we might come up with it after we start talking about containers. With respect to containers, should we pivot to that? I remember explicitly talking about not doing anything stateful in containers a decade ago, right? As containers.
Yeah, that was the mantra.
Brett, right? That was, you know, don't do stateful. Obviously, that story has changed dramatically over the last 5 years, I would say, maybe even a little bit longer. But yeah, so tell us more about Postgres and containers. Like, is it an issue? Does it matter anymore? Are the pain points all gone and it's hunky-dory?
No, I mean, I would say, so compared to, you know, 10 years ago, I would have probably told you, you know, maybe think more about why you're putting in a container. I think these days, it really depends, I think, what your context is. Like today, it's maybe, 10 years ago was probably not, right? So it definitely has changed, I think. Really, I mean, if I look back 15 years ago, we didn't even have Docker, right? We have LXC containers and whatnot. And definitely then, you know, there was no point in running Postgres in a container. And so, for example, the Postgres Docker image, right, makes it really easy to just start a Postgres container. So it's not a problem to create a Postgres container. Now, the question is, what are you really doing by launching such a container, right? And I think you really need to think about the statefulness of the whole problem, right? So if you're just talking raw containers, we're not talking Kubernetes, right? Just the Docker container. Ultimately, you know, start by thinking where your volume is at, right? So I mean, the simplest mistake you could make, I don't think people would do this, but let's just say you don't do a volume mount, right? And so then accidentally you drop your data because you're like doing something like Docker Compose down, and then, you know, it just drops the volume.
Been there.
Yeah. I've been there on my own machine locally. So, you know, not in production, luckily. But so I think, you know, we need to think about, first of all, is it production or dev staging, right? So I think for production, I don't personally see a big benefit of using something like Docker for just running a Postgres container. I don't think you're gaining much, right? I think there are, for production use cases, there's a lot we could talk about on Kubernetes, right? So just over the years, just to give you some context on where I'm coming from. So I'm not necessarily an expert on this field, but I've seen various ways of doing this, right? So there is, I'm sure, other opinions out there. But to just give you context on what I've done in the past, so I've been on the kind of team that was running a database as a service where we were not using containers. We just had, you know, virtual machines that we provisioned for customers. This was back at a company called Citus Data where we were doing distributed Postgres. And so we had, you know, many servers, many virtual machines being provisioned. There was like a central state machine that was kind of controlling, you know, bringing up VMs, tearing them down, kind of like a mini Kubernetes of sorts, right? But built as a custom state machine for managing databases as a service. And so that's one of the experiences I have, you know, actually running Postgres in production. And then later, when I was at Microsoft, I, you know, kind of was involved with different ways of deploying containers there. And so we did have both a project to use kind of Postgres in a Kubernetes environment and building a custom kind of operator for that deployment. And then also there was a project that was running Postgres inside a container, just inside a VM. So it was just essentially a way of managing the packages more efficiently. And so, and many years ago also, I've run Postgres just in virtual machines myself, right? So in these days, just to be clear, I actually don't run Postgres myself on PG Analyze, for example. Behind the scenes, we use Amazon RDS today. So we don't actually manage our own Postgres in a virtual machine or a container. But I think what I've seen over the years, right, is that of all the different approaches there, the one that I haven't really seen a benefit of is just running Postgres in a container, because the container, like if I think of my application in a container, right, I gain a lot of benefits, right? I have, you know, the ability, so our application is Ruby and Rust. And so just, you know, the ability to have the right Ruby version and not worry about, you know, Debian based system, like configuring things correctly, like containers pay off very quickly, right? So we deploy our application using containers, right? So that makes a lot of sense. But Postgres is not that way, right? Postgres is really just one package, maybe two packages that you really need to have, like the server and the contract packages. And so in that sense, you don't have this complexity of managing the different things to install. And so I think, you know, in a production environment, I don't see a benefit of just Docker and Postgres, but I do think Kubernetes brings additional things.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like the maturity model, right? Of a developer that is all on board to containers. So their first sort of foray is the standard official Postgres image from Docker Hub. There's variants of that. I think there's an Alpine version probably. And then we have ARM and Intel versions. And then before, we had people in chat talking about like HA and some of the other, I guess, edge case. It's not really an edge case, but
no, HA is important.
Yeah, it's not really a part or focus of the official image. You mentioned before the show something that I don't know about, because like you said, I don't run my own Postgres daily in a production sense, so I'm not constantly worried about it. If I'm going to use it, it's going to be a cloud hosted, you know, RDS or something like that. It's going to be like that. But you mentioned this cloud native PG before the show. It seems to be Kubernetes specific.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think what's really interesting with Postgres, so first of all, since somebody asked about HA, I do want to briefly address HA, and I think we'll talk more about it. But one of the things you have to figure out, right, when you're running Postgres in production is how you're managing when a host goes down or when there's some fault that requires you to switch over to a replica, right? And so back when we were running our own kind of system for managing virtual machines to run Postgres, this was one of the most important things, right, is having a state machine that knows, hey, the host has gone bad, fail over or recover from backup or do all this stuff that, you know, you essentially expect in a lifecycle of a database, right? And so when we look at how to run Postgres and Kubernetes, there have been many different ways to do this over the years, right? So the cloud native PG operator is one of the more modern ones, I would say, that, you know, came out, I think, roughly 2 years ago, that a team at EDB is managing. And it's a community project, but they're kind of the main contributors. And so this is not the official operator, right? There is no official operator, but this is, I would say, one of the ones you should be considering when you are thinking of running Postgres and Kubernetes. And so what the team at Cloud Native PG has done, which I think is really interesting, is they spent a lot of time thinking, how do we, like, this lifecycle management of a Postgres database, right? Like these primaries, these replicas, the backups, right? Like the archiving of the ball stream. Talk more about that if you want. But the point is, right, there's all these kind of moving parts you have to manage that are not just the running server. And they've really spent time trying to say, how do we map this to the primitives, like the basic resources in Kubernetes, right? How do we make this so this is really truly a Kubernetes project, right? And not something that, you know, feels like it belongs elsewhere. And I think, for example, when you look at other operators, right? So for example, one that I think has had a lot of production use also is the Crunchy database Postgres operator. And that one, for example, if I was using Postgres in production on Kubernetes today, I would seriously consider this one, not necessarily a cloud native PG one, just for its history, right? Because this has been around for many years, but you can definitely see that their architectural decisions, they're not, you know, as I would say, absolute in terms of, you know, how to do the best possible way of mapping a Postgres lifecycle onto Kubernetes. I think this is more of a, you know, practical, let's just get this running. Let's solve the, you know, let's have a way to do HA. Let's have a way to do extensions. Let's have a way to do upgrades. And so it's been really interesting to see these different takes on running Postgres in Kubernetes.
Do you have to have a solid way of handling your PVs, your volume mounts and the PV claims and all that kind of stuff before, like there's some prerequisites for using these operators, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely need a way to provision volumes, right? I mean, I think what's interesting is the cloud native PG operator actually doesn't use stateful sets. So to manage its state, it essentially, they built their own logic and they have like arguments of why they did it. And apparently one of the arguments they have is, if I capture this correctly, and please, you know, somebody from their team listens to this, please, you know, like in a comment tells me what I got wrong. But my understanding is that one of the things you have your database do is resize volumes, right? So like your data is growing, right? So you're giving it a certain initial allocation. Mm-hmm. And so one of the issues of stateful sets seems to be, if you just, you know, use the standard way of how it integrates with PVs, is that it's not easy to just resize a volume. And so one of the reasons why the cloud native PG operator essentially went with their own implementation of stateful sets is because they felt that it was better for, you know, if you have this online resizing where you're not actually taking down the pod, then it would be better to have their own custom implementation. In my understanding, from an end user perspective, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to provision things differently, right? I think you could still, you know, if your Kubernetes is hooked up to a way to provision a cloud network storage, right, then that's essentially what you need, in my understanding. But it's interesting that they found it necessary to kind of go beyond the basics that Kubernetes has to offer in that sense.
Yeah, the Kubernetes primitives. Interesting. There's a whole infinite surface area of stuff to talk about with respect to that, I'm sure.
We got some questions. Well, real quick, this might be a quick one. Kubernetes is also a PG operator. Any opinion about it?
I don't have an opinion about it. I don't have any personal experience with it. I would just, you know, if you're looking, I mean, maybe an interesting thing we could talk about briefly is how should you assess an operator, right? Like why, if you're making a decision between Cloud Native PG and the Crunchy Postgres operator and a Kubegrass operator and a Stackgrass operator and all the, there's like the Zalando operator, I could, you know, the list goes on and on. So how should you make that decision? So somebody else mentioned HA, I think. And so one of the things I would definitely try to understand is how is it managing HA, right? So if something fails, what happens? And so for example, just again, comparing the two where I have a little bit more knowledge about, which would be the Crunchy one and the Cloud Native PG one. So the Crunchy one, you know, kind of interacts with existing community projects essentially. And that's actually what a lot of other operators also do is they use a project called Petroni to do failovers. And Petroni is essentially a, like, think of it as a way to manage state again, right? So the problem here is who makes a decision when the database has gone bad. And so what a lot of the operators do is they use a project called Petroni, which the team at Zalando actually created initially. They also made their own operator. But even if you don't use the Zalando operator, you can still essentially see Petroni used in a lot of these projects because it is a good way to say, you know, when have things gone bad? When do we fail over? And so as you're evaluating things, right, one of the most important things to understand is this using Petroni? Is this using something else? Petroni has a lot of production experience, but it also has a bunch of moving parts, right? And so what the Cloud Native PG operator, for example, has done is they actually built their own implementation of failing over in HA, which, you know, in a sense sounds good, right? Because so they're describing it as we did this because we felt that it was better to use, you know, built-in Kubernetes ways of doing this and managing state. So in a sense, that's a good thing. But it also means if I, you know, look at that, I'm like, ah, you know, this seems a bit fragile potentially, right? So because they essentially reinvented the wheel, which I think is probably the right choice in this context. But it still means if I'm looking for something to run in production right now, I might want to have something for HA that has a lot more history essentially over the years, right? And so I think I would say HA is probably one of the more important things to understand. I think somebody else also mentioned multi-clusters, right? And how can I manage Postgres replicating across clusters? And so if that is one of your use cases, definitely try to understand how the operator might be able to manage or not manage a Postgres that runs across different regions, different AZs in the same cluster, right? So can you have like pod affinity, right? Can you say, place, you know, the replica in a different AZ because if one AZ goes down, you want to have sure, you know, that things fall over correctly. Can you, you know, kind of have things replicate into a totally different cluster, right? Is there a way to essentially get the replication stream synced up? So for example, the Cloud Native PG operator, it does support a cluster that spans zones, but then if you had two different clusters that you're synchronizing, it requires you to do a manual failover, which is probably what you want in my experience, right? So if you're really going just like cross region, like I have my, you know, US region and my Europe region, and if the whole of US is down, what do I want to do? Probably not automatically fail over, right? Because if you for some reason have like a brief network outage or something, and then suddenly everything starts moving to Europe, that's probably not the right thing. But yeah, this is how I would kind of look at, I would look at these, you know, fundamental, how does it decide where to run? How does it decide to fail over? I think that's really one of the most important aspects.
So it seems like you have to start with a pretty good understanding of your risk profile with respect to the data and the use case for Postgres, then match that against the HA, well, guarantees or the HA implementation of these different choices and whether that's appropriate for your risk and resiliency profile that you're trying to achieve, which is general advice for cloud native anyway.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, maybe just to mention this again, right? Like you should definitely ask yourself, is it right to run a database in Kubernetes, right? Because I think the answer to this might be no, right? Like the answer might be you should be using Amazon RDS or Azure Database for Postgres or GCP Cloud SQL. They will manage that whole state machine stuff for you, right? And they'll charge you a nice premium for it, right? So don't get me wrong. If you're optimizing for cost, it's not the right way to go necessarily. But if you don't have the expertise to think about these problems in your team, it's probably better to not assume the operator magically takes care of it, right? Because there are things to understand about how this works. And so unless you know, want to get into how the operator handles these certain conditions, it's probably better to just defer, you know, running a database to the cloud provider.
I'm not going to disagree.
No, you know, yeah. I mean, AWS gets money anyway, right? You run your database in Kubernetes, you run your database in RDS, AWS is happy. So
yeah, I think it's a pretty consistent message we've been putting out for some time now that just because you can doesn't mean you should. And that is very much the use case of databases. I mean, it's funny that one of the first things we started talking about here when we're talking about all these different operators is like volume expansion. Because, I mean, we were dealing with volume expansion 20 years ago. We were dealing with, when we started virtualizing storage and we needed to, you know, we didn't even have containers yet. We were dealing with challenges of always online databases and how do we expand those volumes. And then we had, when it was sort of the concept of, I'm trying to remember the right term we used back then, you have sort of volumes that look bigger than they are. I mean, one of you probably knows the right term for that. So there's really only 100 gig in the storage, but your volume looks like it's a terabyte. And we dealt with that for a while. We're like, well, this solves the temporary problem of making it look like there's not enough storage. We can add storage later. And then there's actually adding the storage. I mean, I've got so many battle scars, I feel like, from keeping databases on. And one of the questions that's maybe not in line here next, but one of the things I keep thinking about is, if we shift from the tech for a second, we talk about the people and the archetypes or the roles that are today. I haven't really worked heavily with a team that's sort of dealing with large, you know, terabytes and terabytes of databases in production, multi-zone, multi-region kind of scenarios. I'm in the DevOps side nowadays, so I don't have to deal with that anymore. But maybe my 2000s to 2010, 2015 era was more working directly with a database team. And that was back in the old school days. We didn't really have the term DevOps necessarily at the time, but you had a developer team, you had an ops team, sys/sysadmins, like that's where I was. And then you had a dedicated database team. And I can remember very heavily working with this dedicated, they worked full-time all day on Oracle and Microsoft SQL and all these sort of traditional enterprise-y solutions. What does that look like today? Like in terms of the makeup, I think there's a lot of people that are maybe coming to this and they haven't worked with larger teams or even smaller teams that might justify a dedicated database administrator. Do you even see that anymore? Is that, I mean, obviously like the large companies or the AWSs of the world have it, but do you see teams of 10 having a dedicated SQL person in there, or is it everyone expected to know how to expand volumes and like do HA setups in SQL and know what backups and restores look like? I mean, there's just so much to it. It's hard to imagine.
I mean, I think also some of these things are definitely more on the infrastructure side, right? Like they're not necessarily, it's the same as if you're running anything else in Kubernetes, for example, right? Or stateful things. I think what's interesting is when you look at, you know, how DevOps and system administrators kind of relate to each other, right? So 20 years ago, you were a sysadmin, and today you definitely would not be a sysadmin anymore. Like it's rare that I talk to anybody who identifies as a system administrator. And the same thing I think has happened with database administrators, where people, unless you talk like large enterprises with, you know, history, maybe they're using Oracle, they probably still call themselves DBAs. But I think for the most part these days, you would probably see somebody call themselves data engineer, data platform engineer, sometimes application DBAs, right? And so just when you're looking for these people, right, they might not have the DBA title on them. But usually what I see in, you know, kind of larger companies, as they kind of have many hundreds of databases to manage, you would usually under the infrastructure team, you would have a dedicated data or data platform team. And those would be the people that know best, you know, what are the best practices for managing Postgres? If something goes really bad, you know, who do you call? You call the data platform team, right? So
And then you have the, with machine learning and data science, you have an unfortunate data scientist who just happens to know a little bit more Linux command line than anyone else, and then is in the unfortunate role of being the de facto like data processing nerd on the team, and has to kind of oversubscribe on that knowledge as well, and kind of coming in from hey, I need to just get this data processed and ready for doing data science work, and no one else is doing that for me, so now I got to learn all these other things just to get my data in the proper shape. So we see a lot of that as well.
I can imagine, you know, there's a sort of a theme on the internet that developers are expected to know too much. You know, there's this sort of general complaint that, why do I have to know Kubernetes now too? Like, I'm already creating the applications, I'm learning how to package them, test them, deploy them, and now I got to manage infrastructure. There's too much stuff for me. But I can remember almost 20 years ago, up until even like 15 years ago, where I was actually working with teams of groups of DBAs, like we're just talking about, that their goal was to actually consolidate everything into a single database system. In the specific case I was remembering, they were focused on Microsoft SQL. We were moving off Oracle. Open source had really not taken hold in the late 2000s, essentially. This was in government, so of course, moving slower. And they were trying to consolidate everything to a single tool. And we had multiple versions. We had three or four different versions in production, but we were always like, let's focus everything on this particular one. And now I can just imagine, and this is an imagination, I'm sort of looking for some confirmation, Lucas, but that if you're a data engineer, you're dealing with half a dozen or more different types of data. Like, you've got a lot more under your belt than just Postgres, and you've got to manage a lot of different things. Like we talked about vector databases. I can see how some of those data engineers might be dealing with some sort of maybe not S3 specifically, but stuff that is maybe not so much more the traditional SQL sense. What do you see people coming in, especially with PG Analyze and stuff like that, where they're running other systems as well, other different tools. Is this a, sort of a problem for all of us now where we have way too many things to manage and too many tools to deal with?
I mean, it's complicated, right? So I think, for example, you mentioned vector databases, right? So, I mean, I think what I do see is a lot of people that use Postgres end up using Postgres for a lot of these different workloads, right? So you might be, you know, again, 10 years ago, you might be using MongoDB, but then Postgres added JSONB. And so now you can use like MongoDB type workloads in Postgres, right? Usually what I would find, let's say there's a team of five data platform engineers, there's probably, you know, half of them are somewhat well-versed in Postgres, and they will actually spend the majority of their time working with Postgres, right? I think oftentimes maybe what you see is legacy systems, right? People move off from Oracle or SQL Server towards Postgres. That's a very frequent thing I see. Sometimes, you know, they make that over many years, right? So you will often have people kind of have a dual role of like an Oracle DBA and then, you know, Postgres data platform engineer or whatever you want to call it, right? On the relational database side, I think usually people try to gravitate towards one solution. I do think that, you know, when we talked a little bit about like working with data and exporting it, right, or having business intelligence type things. And so certainly what I do see is people using things like Snowflake or ClickHouse to do like other analysis. I mean, Snowflake is more on the, you know, business ETL side. ClickHouse would be more on the, I have a column in a store that I want to, you know, run. Whilst, for example, Postgres has a way to store column of data, it's probably not the best way to store column of data. And so I would say probably the most common pattern I would see there is probably having a good solution for columnar, which with something like ClickHouse. And then the other thing that I do see is also when people are like, you know, they're at the scale of, let's say, DoorDash, for example. I have a public case study, so I can talk about this, where DoorDash for some of their servers uses CockroachDB as well, right? So CockroachDB is essentially, it's Postgres compatible, but it's really not Postgres. It's kind of a built from the ground up way of having a distributed database. And so for some of their workloads, they use that. And again, they have a public case study if you want to know more of that. But obviously their team has to then split the attention, right? Like some of the databases being Postgres, some of them being Cockroach.
Yeah, that's, I don't think we've had a show on CockroachDB specifically, but
added to the list, Brett.
Yeah. But that, they've definitely been, I mean, because they were one of the earlier, you know, sort of container friendly or container native kind of ideas around databases. Real quick, we're going to get, let me throw a question in here. What is the state of running Postgres HA across multi-cluster as Stateful said? Is there any progress in the direction as I knew Postgres operator still has no support for multi-cluster setup?
I think it's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you, unfortunately, is the truth of it. I think in my understanding is it's not a done deal, is how I look at the problem from what I understand. This is probably something I would do research on. And I would look, again, like the operators I would look at is the Cloud Native PG one, the Crunchy one, possibly the Zalando one, although that one is, I would say, that one probably isn't as advanced as the other ones, but it has a lot of, you know, things under its belt. But it probably is the one that definitely doesn't support multi-cluster things well. I do know that Cloud Native PG team has that on their roadmap to a certain extent, but I don't know exactly what capabilities it has today for actually managing things across clusters or setting things up across clusters. So my understanding is it's definitely still manual work.
Yeah, it feels like the cross-cluster and especially anything that's cross-region, the cross-cluster stuff in Kubernetes, I mean, that's sort of been for a lot of us, whether it's the ingress and the proxies, or take any add-on on top of a cluster, any extra controllers, and getting it across multiple clusters is sort of the last piece of the puzzle, I think, for a lot of these. I think a couple of years ago, we had Contour on talking about a separate project they were working on for Envoy Proxy just to get multi-cluster setups. And it's all very complicated and very hard. So I can only imagine what it's like for databases, because I haven't dealt with it in databases myself either. But that feels like that's like the utopia of I can spin up as many clusters as I want and I can use the same tools for managing all of them. And all these things talk across cluster and across region and everything's wonderful. And sadly, I feel like for 10 years, we've been giving these answers of, you know, cross IP subnets used to be a hard thing decades ago. Like we're slowly arriving at a state where most applications, including clusters themselves, can actually perform across boundaries of networking and regions and stuff like that. So I'm not surprised that cross-cluster Postgres operators is still in its maybe not final state. That seems like something that would be.
And if you're considering that, that's definitely the hard mode right now, right? That's the edge of Kubernetes. I think Kubernetes was designed as the cluster being the main boundary.
Yeah.
And this is, we need something else, like the next abstraction layer is still being built and envisioned and kind of explored, I think.
Yeah.
And what I would add also, I think, is what are you really looking for with a multi-cluster setup, right? Is the motivation, for example, to bring data closer to your, you know, end users, right? Like maybe you're essentially doing like an edge kind of distribution type thing. Are you trying to, you know, have better HA, right? So I think it's really a question of what are you trying to achieve? Because just replicating things everywhere and then, you know, imagining that things will automatically work kind of neglects the fact that latency is really important, right? So like once I start going, you know, beyond a couple of milliseconds of latency, things really will start breaking down, right? And so a lot of times I see people on the requirements list, they have, you know, cross-region HA and like they want everything to just be super available. But then when it comes down to, you know, how do you actually want this to work? You realize that people haven't really thought about the speed of light type problems, essentially.
Yeah, you still can't break physics, right? No matter how
far as I know.
Well, and this is the balance, right? Because it's trade-offs. It's all trade-offs. And I think this is part of what's happening in talking about DBAs everywhere when consolidating. I mean, we want simplicity. We want less to manage because that's the only way that any of us ever actually escaped. I mean, I was the sysadmin, right? And I escaped it into managing many more things because we simplified management, we simplified architecture. You know, there was a day where I was assigning IP addresses manually to machines and then putting it in a spreadsheet.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's how we tracked IPs, right? We didn't have DHCP yet in the data center. Data center was like the last place to get get DHCP. It was actually a security concern for us 20 years ago because we thought if a rogue machine shows up on the network, it's going to automatically get an IP and be able to route everywhere. We don't want that. We want it to be harder. So people, we have challenges. And if you try to make everything infinitely scalable and infinitely expandable with all of the fault tolerances at every single level, you're going to need Netflix. Like you're going to need a Google team. You're going to need an AWS team to help you do that. I walk into teams all the time. I mean, I think that's one of the nice things about being a consultant is you get a perspective of all different types of organizations and everyone's struggling, right? Everyone's trying to increase HA, increase battle testing before things go to production. Everyone doesn't feel like any of this is good enough for them. And they're always trying to make it better. So And that's probably why you have your company. It's because everything needs to be better.
And also trying to balance, right? Performance, cost, uptime, whatever, latency, right. And then kind of not stumbling in the dark, but kind of exploring all the edges there and making mistakes, experimenting, trying different things out. For sure.
And I would say, before we jump to that question, I would also caution people to, you know, not cosplay large organizations unnecessarily, right? Like, it's like sometimes people adopt Kubernetes because that's, you know, the thing that you should be using when really you don't need Kubernetes. You just need a container and ECS, right? And so I think, you know, there's this whole story around you want to be big, you want to do it proper, but maybe the time isn't right for that yet, right? Maybe you should be thinking about where you're at with your own application, how you can keep it simpler, right? Versus making it more complicated.
I was talking to a customer, it was a small startup, and I asked them why they were adopting Kubernetes, and they said because they were bored. And I was just like,
a bored startup is not a good sign.
And I was like, oh, okay. But yeah, there's a lot of that going on as well.
And then and there's a little bit of a culture challenge here, just a little bit of a segue is like, Nirmal and I go to these KubeCons, and we've been going to DockerCon and KubeCon for a decade now, or close to a decade, and there's definitely a culture in the open source community, and I think Cloud Native is maybe even sort of a pinnacle of that because it's all open source, and of course, there's all these vendor booths that have quasi-open source or open core or whatever they have, and there's not necessarily a culture there of, let me find a cloud service to solve this problem first. It's a little bit of a culture of, let me find an open source tool to implement myself to solve this problem first. And I feel like I've always been that person in the middle where I stand like right on the line, 50-50. And on one side, I have all these closed source SaaSes. And on this other side, I have all this open source. And it just depends. And a lot of times, I don't have the people or the time to implement a piece of open source when there's this shiny thing like RDS or AWS App Runner, which can run containers for me so easy. Click, 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 done. I don't need a kube control. I don't need a Kubernetes manifest. I don't need all these other things. So I think, and we're a little bit guilty on this show. We invite all these wonderful people on to talk about open source and SaaSes and the where all that mixes. So for those of you out there, if you haven't figured out already, I don't know about Nirmal. I mean, he works at AWS, but for me, I sit in the middle. I like both. There are right cases for both. So if you're looking at how do I save time, it may not be open source that saves you time. It might be a SaaS product. I'm not trying to make an ad for PG Analyze or anything like that, but it feels like one because we've got someone already in chat that's a fan that says, I am really interested with PG Analyze, what would bring to the table? And we haven't really talked about it. So we've only got a few minutes left. I know we have other topics we can always get into, but should we go back to PG Analyze real quick and talk a little bit about what it does?
Yes, I would say definitely there are open source solutions to what we're doing as well. And we do publish some of what we do as open source, but it's more like libraries that we use internally. So the product itself is a SaaS product that you pay for, which is why how we sustain a team of engineers working on a product, you know, is how this works. And so what PG Analyst does is really on the performance side, right? So it doesn't really matter whether you're running in a container, you're running Kubernetes, or you're running on a virtual machine or an RDS. The idea essentially is that if you're optimizing Postgres performance, you're trying to understand, why is my query slow? Which part of the query is slow, right? Am I missing an index? All these kind of questions that you might ask yourself. There are ways to do this without PG Analyze, but you're just going to spend a lot of hours reading on materials of how to do it. A lot of hours, you know, making spreadsheets. If you're like looking at a query workload and you're trying to say across these 100 queries, which index should I be using? And so really the idea is that we're collecting all that telemetry data. And then I think somebody else in a different context mentioned AI, right? And so we don't say AI, but we do have advisors in the product as well. And the idea behind the advisors is that they essentially look at all that workload data coming in, that they make suggestions like, hey, change this configuration setting or add this index, right? So the idea is that we essentially make it easier for people to operate Postgres as a production system, be that in Kubernetes or in a virtual machine or an RDS.
Very good.
Awesome. What's a question that if someone finds themselves asking this kind of question, PG Analyze would be the right thing to step into or to start using?
You mean what is the question they would be asking to then come to us to solve the question?
Yeah. So like maybe I'm an application developer and I find myself in a situation where, you know, I ask this question to myself.
Right.
And then PG Analyze would be the solution to that or help point me in the right direction.
I think it's definitely not, you know, why should I be running Postgres in a container? I think this is a question we will not help you answer. We hopefully give you some pointers
That's
today
what
here.
This show's for.
Exactly. And we could probably talk more about it for, you know, full hour. But just, you know, the question that would make you come to PG Analyze, I think, is more, why is my query slow? Right. So like what we talked about at the very beginning, I think, you know, why is this slow? You know, like the database is this magic box, right? What is happening behind the scenes? And so really a lot of what we're doing, right, is like we build custom visualizations, for example. We try to really invest into making it easier to understand what's going on behind the scenes. Because I think that's really what, so, you know, talking about AI for a moment, what I think personally is even if we have advisors, for example, I always want to make it clear how we come upon the recommendations, right? So what I don't want to have is like a ChatGPT that says, create this index, change, you know, rewrite this query like this. And you don't even know what it was doing behind the scenes, right? And so I think that this is kind of where we're coming from, is it's very much the get the data, visualize the data, make it easier to understand, find the right things, and then in some cases also give you the recommendations.
Awesome. I think there's a good fit between PG Analyze or those kind of tools and something like OpenTelemetry tracing, right? So if you've done some tracing, you've done some more advanced proactive observability on your application, your microservices, as part of that trace, you're likely, you know, your API, your backend is going to hit a database at some point, maybe. And this then pairs nicely with, oh, I find that my trace shows that this query took X amount of minutes and it should take X amount of seconds, switch over to PG Analyze to figure out what's going on there, right?
And so the good news is, so we have an OpenTelemetry integration for exactly this reason. So we can actually, as of September last year, we can actually push spans into your traces where it will show, hey, here's a slow query plan, essentially. And then it takes you to PG Analyze for details. And in this topic, if you're interested in it, if any of you listening is interested in that, I actually was on a podcast on Observability Cast with Charity Majors and Jessica Kerr from Honeycomb last year. I'll see if I can take out the link so we can at least include it in the podcast description. But that's essentially an episode where we just talked about how can we combine tracing data, you know, across the database and the application, because that really, you know, kind of demystifies the database again, right? A lot of this is demystifying what the database is doing.
Awesome. Nice. Another thing for the list, Brett, OpenTelemetry.
Yeah. Yeah. We know Charity and they got a good group over there. We've had Honeycomb on the show before, but that's awesome. Well, this has been, okay, so I've learned a lot. And also I think we could all sum it up as it's complicated, but PG Analyze can help. And containers may not always be the right answer.
And do your research, right? I think that's what I would say. It's like, look at the different operators. If you're looking to deploy Postgres and Kubernetes, there are different options out there. And it's really a question of researching the different options.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I didn't realize there were so many options out there. So that's also, sometimes it's harder when there's so many choices and you have to really do your research rather than just being one clear, most popular, you know, it's got 10X or 100X the GitHub stars of everything else. And you can clear that. sometimes I just appreciate that because it's like, it's just so much complexity in researching and trying to figure out what the right choices are and unbiased answers, which are hard to find on the internet, right? Well, thank you, Lucas, so much for being here. I feel like we've answered lots of questions and we could spend another couple of hours here. The last question, by the way, if we can keep this one short, what is the hardest operational problem you have encountered running Postgres in containers? And then if it's not the OOM killer, how do you contain it? I feel like that's a leading question.
It is a leading question, but definitely the out-of-memory killer can be a big pain. The other thing, I'll just mention this since we didn't get time to talk about it earlier, and I think it's just one thing that's important to understand. If you're somebody who really likes extensions in containers, this is not necessarily a production problem where you have an operational issue, but something you need to think about is your application developers might want to run extensions. And so it's actually quite painful to manage extensions in a container with Postgres. So if you want to use pgvector, for example, you need to use the pgvector image. If you want to use PostJS, you need to use the PostJS image. And so it's just one thing I'll mention. It's not an operational problem. It's more of a practical problem if you're running Postgres in a container, is watch out for extensions.
Yeah. So you have to end up building your own, which, yeah.
That was number three. We got the third one.
That's true.
Yeah, you have to wait till the... We're going to change the title of Wait Till the End for the third one.
Yes.
You'll never believe what happens at the end of the show. Very
That's
good.
Awesome.
Well, thanks again, Lucas. I'm looking forward to hearing some of those people coming back and telling us how they improved their Postgres from learning stuff on this show. If I had Postgres in production, I would be improving it from stuff we learned in this show. But I feel like I learned a lot.
Awesome.
Thanks, Lucas. Thanks, Nirmal.
Cool. Thank you.
Bye, y'all.
Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.